Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Cinephiles Live here on Sunday, April 13th on the West Coast, 3 p.m. PT. I am one of your co-hosts. I am John Rocha, joined as always by the stunning one over there, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
Well, stunning as always, obviously. And since you're giving your exact location, I feel like I should give the latitude and longitude of my Los Angeles office, just so we're being very, very clear with the time and location stamp on this video.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I just, you know, want to do something different in how we did our live shows today, because, you know, Steve, we are doing this show today. Yet again, another month, another incredible actor passes away. Our last live show, I think, was on Gene Hackman. And before that, actually, a couple months before that, we had done one on James Earl Jones. And today we are offering up our tribute, remembrances, and discussions on the career and legacy of the great Val Kilmer, who sadly passed away recently at 65 years old from pneumonia after battling throat cancer for a majority of the past 10 years. But someone who, Steve, I think leaves an interesting legacy in the world of film, it's television slightly, but mostly film, and an interesting man to talk about. So as we go forward, we will talk all of that, but just a reminder that Streamlabs and Super Chats are open, so we'd love to hear what you all think about Val Kilmer. You can send in your Streamlabs right there. The address is right above Steve's head, and it's our heads, rather, and it's the Super Chats. You all know how to do that. So, Steve, I'll go to you first before we bring up anything and have any conversation about the man's life or his movies. What is your feeling all these days later about the passing of Val Kilmer?
I'll tell you, I'm in an odd place about it because last night I started watching and then finished at half hour ago the documentary Val.
Yes.
Which I hadn't watched. Mm-hmm. And it was really moving. Mm-hmm. So the reason I say I'm in an odd place is, like, at this moment, I'm not really thinking as much about the great performances and the great movies and him as an actor and his place in the film world. I'm really just sort of thinking about him as a human. And I have what's interesting about that documentary is just how very, very human he feels to me now, you know, just like a real person struggling with his own stuff. And that's, it really moved me. So that's kind of where I am right now.
It's understandable. I was very lucky early on in building the Outlaw Nation to get to interview the directors of Val and his two children, which is up on my channel if you guys want to watch that video. But they were amazing. The two directors, they had so much love for Val Kilmer. They were so honored that they got a chance to tell his story. And it was great to spend like 5-8 minutes with them as they talked about the experiences of working with Al, talking with Val, and then working with his kids, because it's Val Kilmer's son, Jack, who voices over the whole movie doing his father's voice, and his daughter, Mercedes, is in it as well. And so I think this is a great thing you bring up. Aside from all the movies, sometimes we forget that these actors are human beings. The famous actors, they are human beings. They go through the things that human beings go through, which... they're young and full of piss and vinegar and vibrant and then artistic and creative and unique. They meet a beautiful woman. They fall in love. They get married. They have children. They divorce. They get difficult to work with. They go through the stages of not being bankable, not being employable, and then come back and get reappreciated all over again because they decorated our worlds. But, you know, these are the things that are interesting that a lot of people go through in life, getting married, getting divorced, having kids, having figured all that stuff out. Amidst their jobs, amidst trying to succeed at their job. So it's a fascinating documentary that I think put, as you said, Steve, a very human point of view on this man and helps you to appreciate him even more as a person, because he does not shy away from the rumors of him being difficult to work with, and he leans into it. And you can appreciate this as an older rebel now, as he passed away. But like, he was so rebellious at the beginning because he was unusually gifted and talented and intelligent. And, you know, we've seen that with a number of people who are this gifted in the world of creativity. They have trouble being normal with everyone else. But thankfully, Val was one of those that was able to get a documentary like that that helped us to reappreciate him and tell his story from his point of view, which I think is great.
It's funny. We kind of said this, I think, when we did some of our intros, because we re-released Top Gun and Heat, some of the movies we've done in the past with new intros. And we were talking about the mismatch between the sort of supporting actor guy and the movie star body and the Hollywood wanting to make him a movie star. And the thing that really struck me watching that documentary, and I'm sure we'll talk about this as we go along, but is that really, if he hadn't looked the way he looked and gotten the fame that he got, he fits in with my wacky theater friends who were busily doing a one-act play about, you know, the Marquis de Sade or something in some little tiny theater in Berkeley somewhere. Like that's the kind of stuff that he would be doing. You know what I mean? Like he would be my artsy fartsy actor friend, except who are just busily working on their crazy projects. That's what he would be doing, except for the fact that he happened to become a movie star. And I think, and I kind of go to the difficultness and all the stuff is the weird mismatch between the crazy artist soul that he had and playing Batman, you know, things don't work together. And so of course it was difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. The creativity thing I think is an important thing to remember with him, because I think you nail it on the head saying that he has this artistic streak that causes him to be curious about the world and question the world and rebel against the world and think that things should be a certain way. But you mix that in with also, I mean, it's very Brando-esque. It's you mix that in with also his just innate, and I would, from what I've read and seen, the instinctual knowledge he had that he was superior in his talent to most people, and he knew it. And in that way, that allows him to mess with people, allows him to be a little difficult to work with. But also when he's turned on, you're marveling at the guy's ability to find this unusual approach to acting. I think it's Michael Mann who said David Mamet said this. He's one of the greats. And you know why he's one of the greats? Because only the greats make acting look like they're improvising every single second they're on the screen. And Val Kilmer was one of those people who would do that. And of course, Mamet directed him in Spartan, which is one of my quietly favorite Val Kilmer films. And so you appreciate that with him as an actor. And Steve, you make an excellent point too. How does the artistic soul figure out Hollywood? How does it navigate Hollywood when they're this attractive and blonde and those gorgeous eyes and that great physique, when they want to shove him into places to become a superstar?
Right.
Go be Batman, go be this, go be that, you know? And I think there was an element of Val Kilmer that constantly pushed against it. And so being the, as you said, the character actor in the leading man's body, he became a great secondary character or co-star in a lot of the great movies that people remember him in, you know?
No, I think that's what's so interesting about him. Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. I mean, and it's funny too, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit. I knew nothing about his origins, his family, his childhood, like all that stuff that I sort of found out, and it put some of those pieces together that I really didn't understand about him in the past.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get into it here. He and I'll bring up a picture of him so you don't just see my face reading facts. But he was born Val Edward Kilmer in Los Angeles. He's a Los Angelino, Steve. He was born on New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1959. He grew up in the Chatsworth neighborhood, went to Chatsworth High School. His neighbors were Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. His high school classmates were Kevin Spacey. He dated Mayor Winningham from St. Elmo's Fire and numerous other movies in high school. His father, Eugene, was a real estate developer. His mother, Gladys, they divorced when Val was 9. His younger brother, Wesley, who had epilepsy, drowned in a swimming pool in 1977 when he was 16. And apparently that haunted him for a long time as an actor. And it was used for some of the influence for what he did in Salt and Sea, the character he created in Salt and Sea. He said, "I didn't really get back down to earth until 2 or 3 years after my brother had died." So that's an incredibly tough loss for him very young in his life. He applied to Juilliard in New York and got accepted. He became the youngest student ever admitted at 17 years old to the acting program. My God, imagine that, 17. You're jealous of the guy who's the lead in your school play at 17. This guy's going off to Juilliard at 17. It's kind of mind-blowing. And as you said, he's an inquisitive guy and does the artsy fartsy stuff. He and his several classmates wrote and performed How It All Began, which is an autobiography of the West German urban guerrilla Michael Baumann. So this is some weird, interesting things that they were into after. And then in 1981, after Kilmer graduated, he appeared in a professional production of that play at the Public Theater. It made his Broadway debut in 1983 in The Slab Boys, which is focusing on young workers in a Scottish carpet factory. And that cast included Sean Penn and Kevin Bacon. Sean Penn, Kevin Bacon, Val Kilmer, 1983 on Broadway in a show about young workers in a Scottish carpet factory. Steve, I would have loved to have been there to see that production.
So many things about this. The first one is the big thing I didn't know about was the death of his brother. And mm-hmm. I didn't know, and this all came from, because it's so fresh on my mind, because I literally just watched this documentary. I didn't know that he, like Steven Spielberg, and like the Coen brothers, and like a bunch of other people we talked about, his brother Wesley had a video camera or a film camera, and they made movies all through his childhood. So part of the documentary is seeing these movies they were making as a kid. And it sounds like when his brother died, which is literally right when he's heading off to Juilliard, that it just destroyed him. You know, like it was so much of, and it, most people have had this at a certain point in your life where there is a pillar of your life.
Yeah.
And that changes, whether it's a divorce or a death or your family moves or something like that. And suddenly the world is different. And that's what happened to him. Yeah. And it's that, A, that's really, really interesting. And B, it's interesting to me that he continued to always have video cameras. So mm-hmm. he was just filming things all the time and just following his artistic ideas. And by the way, one more thing again from that documentary is the play with Kevin Bacon and Sean Penn. Apparently he was supposed to be the lead, and then they said, oh, we got Kevin Bacon is going to be in it, can you play the second lead? And he goes, yeah, okay, I guess I'll do it. And then they say, actually, we got Sean Penn too, can you play a much smaller part? So he gets voted down because those two guys come in, which I think is funny. But I do really think it's just so interesting, this idea of taking this theater artsy creative guy and then plugging him into Hollywood and seeing what happens, you know?
Yeah. And you know, when he starts off in Hollywood, he's doing things like Real Genius and Top Secret. These are such unusual roles to start. Top Secret was the first film he ever did, but then Real Genius is shortly afterwards. So these are unusual roles to play, but right from the beginning, you can tell this is a different kind of actor. The way he leans into what's happening in Top Secret, the way he turns this kind of 80s mentor to the younger 80s nerd kid in Real Genius into something that's actually really interesting, and you're fascinated by the guy, you're captivated by the guy, you're compelled to watch him in these roles that normally would be throwaway roles for most other actors. He inhabits them and has fun with them, and there's an impishness and a rebelliousness, but also like this underlying confidence of not taking the world so seriously. This seems to be a thing that courses through all of his work, to not take the world so seriously. And it's interesting to watch it from the beginning. You know, you kind of see where we're going with him. And I would argue these are the things that make those of us who love him so much, love him as much as we do. We feel like he was this soul that was constantly searching and maybe a little lost, but also had this impish childishness to him that we love. And I think that separates him from someone like Sean Penn or Kevin Bacon, and the way he's going to be remembered and revered as the years go on. You know,
it's funny. Someone in the chat wrote, Val Kilmer is greater than Kevin Bacon. And I adore Kevin Bacon, but of course he is, like, in terms of an actor. And I think Kevin Bacon's a really good actor, but I think Val Kilmer is special in a different way. It's funny listening to him talk about Top Secret in the documentary, because I really wanted to believe, because I like Top Secret a lot. I watched it with Jackson. He had never seen it before. He loves Airplane. We watched Airplane again, too. He loves the Naked Gun movies. He loves all that stuff. So I wanted to believe that Val Kilmer was having fun doing Top Secret, which he apparently seems like he was not, you know, because when you're in a movie like Top Secret, well, your job is to act. You are really in service of a particular kind of vision. Right. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't give a lot of space for your method stuff. Like you're here to do, to be within the, you know, the Zucker Abrams world.
Right.
Because the thing, and you kind of hinted at this, and I think it's so true, which is that there are levels to what he does in Top Secret and in Real Genius. And I haven't watched Real Genius in years, but I absolutely love his performance in it, which is the, he's always a little bit ahead of the movie, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
particularly in Real Genius. Obviously, he's playing a genius, so that's part of it. But there's this remove of, I am having a little bit of fun here. And I'll tell you what's funny is there's an actor that I totally associated with Val Kilmer for many years because of Real Genius more than anything else. Mm. And that is Ryan Reynolds. Because if you watch Van Wilder, the first person I think of seeing National Lampoon's Van Wilder is like, oh, he's doing like Val Kilmer from Real Genius. And then later on discovering like Ryan Reynolds and Val Kilmer couldn't be farther from each other. But in playing comedy in this like super charismatic, good looking guy, comedy stuff, they act, Val Kilmer was able to do what Ryan Reynolds later turned into an art form, you know, but Val Kilmer, there's a whole other side. That's not what he wants to do. That is not what he wants to be. He wants to be something else, you know?
Yeah. And so he opens the door to go into Hollywood and takes these roles and commits himself to these roles and has fun with them. And then, of course, from here, we go right into the stratosphere with Top Gun and Willow and then Tombstone, The Doors, Batman Forever. This is where, I mean, it's really, the ascension is quick. He turned down a role in Blue Velvet in order to do Top Gun. He turned down the role in Blue Velvet in order to play Iceman in Top Gun, and arguably is the smarter move. And I think you got to see Val stretch his acting wings a little bit and also be competitive with someone who was so determined to be a movie star in Tom Cruise. So, you know, if you watch the behind the scenes that they released, the number of documentaries they released on Top Gun, you see that they were kept far apart from each other, that there was genuine animosity or animus between Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer, because Val saw Tom as a guy who was like just dead set on becoming this star in the superficiality of stardom. Whereas Val was more focused on becoming the actor and becoming better as an actor and being the actor. He pursued the actor spirit differently than Tom did. I'm not trying to denigrate Tom Cruise. I love Tom Cruise. But clearly these were two different camps and their approaches to Hollywood. And even within Top Gun, you can see the difference in approaches with how Iceman has this effortless confidence and effortless cool, whereas Maverick has to constantly prove himself. And I see that those are the two different energies that are operating throughout that whole movie. And at that time, you imagine Val Kilmer is just this is an extension of who he is as he's coming into his manhood and he's seeing like the reaction people have to him and his attractiveness, you know? And I think it's fascinating to watch that in the Top Gun movie, you know?
I think it's such a weird thing because it's not that Maverick is to Iceman as Cruise is to Kilmer. That's not it exactly, because Tom Cruise is not Maverick in the sense of being wild and irresponsible and those, he's aggressive, definitely. And I would say Val Kilmer is definitely not Iceman in the sense of being totally calm, always by the numbers. He's an artsy fartsy artist guy. But this is the great thing about acting, is that you can take what are the differences between their personality and create an analogy for the actors to be able to play off those real differences in who they are and make those characters work, if that makes sense. Like, I think that Val was able to channel something in Iceman and the conflict or difference in approach with Tom Cruise. So even though he is not a cold as ice person at all, that's not who Val Kilmer is. The difference really, really comes up in terms of these are people that are pursuing very, very different goals. Yep. They both from our 83 is Top Gun? Is that what year it is?
84.
Yeah. Our 1984, they're just like, these are two gorgeous movie stars who are taking the world by storm. But in fact, they're very, very different in their approaches. And that is totally comes across in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. The differences between them is what fuels, as you said, the stuff that's going on there. Top Gun is 1986. Real Genius was 85. Right. And then we have Willow. He does a couple of TV movies here. Murders in the Rue Morgue, which I think is a Edgar Allan Poe run.
Edgar Allan Poe, yeah.
And the man,
Quite, the second, that is the character, is the very first detective stories is the character from Murders in the Rue Morgue and the Purloined Letters. There's a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe trivia today.
And then there's another TV movie, The Man Who Broke a Thousand Chains. So it wasn't like Top Gun, boom, superstardom, right? It was Top Gun, people knew him. Maybe there was a resistance from him. And then Ron Howard comes in with the Willow movie. And this now adds to more of his legacy as he plays this character of Mad Mardigan. So as if Iceman wasn't enough of a well-known, like, iconic kind of character as soon as the movie came out and became a massive success, now you go in and create something else in the world of fantasy and create a character that a lot of people love in Mad Mardigan. And again, you're playing a character, as you said, Steve, he's playing a character who's a little more, he's more like Maverick in that he's more, he's more emotional. He's more impromptu. He doesn't seem to understand the stakes of the things that he's doing, which makes him a very interesting protagonist. One of the two with him and Warwick Davis in that, in Willow, which is fascinating, I think.
So Willow's a weird one for me because, and this goes to, like, I know, like, Vogel loves it, and that's a very important part of his childhood and stuff. And, you know, because I'm 10 years older, so 88, I'm now in college. And so on the one hand, I remember when Willow gets announced, and I was so excited because Ron Howard had started to be a director. I think this is after Splash and Gung Ho at this point. It must be. And so, and I loved Ron Howard, and I obviously love Star Wars. And now it's like George Lucas and Ron Howard are getting together to make a sword and sorcery fantasy movie. My God, I'm thrilled. I was so excited. And I remember going to see it. And totally, we've talked about this thing before where you're having that, you're really rooting for the movie and you really want to like the movie. And Val Kilmer steals every scene he's in. I mean, he's so charismatic. He's every time he's on screen, I like the movie a lot. I did not like Willow that much. And so I decided a couple of days ago, since we were doing this show, you know what? I'm going to rewatch Willow. I haven't seen Willow in 25 years. It's not that good a movie. It really isn't. It's a really flawed film. Val Kilmer is still very charismatic, but sadly, I still to this day go, like, I would love to see this fantasy film. The world is cool. The setup is cool. Val Kilmer is great. I don't particularly like Willow.
I'm not the biggest fan of Willow myself either. I'm only a couple of years behind you. So for me, this was not something that hit me when I was a younger adult, like it has for some of the, like Vogel and a lot of people who watched and enjoyed Willow, which is why that series, everyone was looking forward to that series, but then that series came out and kind of sank. But, after Willow, he plays William Bonney in a TV movie, Billy the Kid. But that's where he also meets Joanne Whalley, who becomes his wife, Joanne Whalley Kilmer. They do a film called Kill Me Again, which didn't really do well. The box office wasn't that well received. And then from there, there's a 2-year hiatus, and boom, he goes in to play Jim Morrison in The Doors. And this, for me personally, coincides at a time when, like, just recently with A Complete Unknown, you and I spoke about how we dove into Dylan stuff inspired by that movie. I dove into The Doors stuff like crazy, inspired by what was happening around the time with the movie. Cause I remember liking Love Me Two Times. And I think and of course, Light My Fire, but I'd never heard Break On Through. I'd never heard a lot of their songs. And so leading up to the movie, because the trailers were just driving me insane how great the movie looked, and then entering into my 20s. So I'm like caught up with the idea of the epic films and biopics. And I remember watching this movie and just being absolutely floored by what Val Kilmer was able to do with Jim Morrison. I do think the movie's not as strong as I was hoping it would be, but I think his performance is absolutely transcendent. And it made me love The Doors as a band and as a group, and Jim Morrison even more so because of that performance. And it's an incredible performance. Didn't win the Oscar. I don't think it was even nominated, yet it's a performance that a lot of people look back on and think it should have won for that year. What are your thoughts on The Doors? Have you seen it a number of times? What do you think of Val Kilmer in the movie?
I think it's one of those performances that it's one of the great biopic rock performances of all time. I mean, I think you put it up. I think, Timothy Chalamet just now in Complete Unknown is, obviously in that league. I think Jamie Foxx is Ray Charles. I think Joaquin Phoenix is Johnny Cash, like I think it's at that level or even transcends that level on, because to some degree, I had this experience a little bit watching Timothy Chalamet as well, where I just forgot that I was not watching Jim Morrison watching that movie. Like it's just like, well, there's Jim Morrison. And I think the movie, it's funny, my friend Matt Garcia, who you know also, his description of Oliver Stone movies is that Oliver Stone has a message. He takes his message, etches it into the side of a Louisville Slugger, and then beats you over the head with it for the next 2 hours to make sure you get it. I don't always agree with that point, but I do feel like there's a quality of some Oliver Stone movies where the first time I see them, they have a powerful, powerful effect on me. And then they have a lesser effect every time I see them after that. And so like, cause you start to see a little bit of the tricks. And so as a performance, it is off the charts, fantastic, top to bottom. What he does is astounding.
Yeah.
As a movie, the when I watched it more and more, because I watched this a fair amount, this was on the VHS rotation for a while.
Yeah.
Is it just there were parts of it that were creepy and upsetting and weird, but then I just cared kind of less and less about the Jim Morrison of that film. But that being said, and this is where, because this is the other thing about Val, he's a method guy. Like Val is going to spend a lot of time, and I know that he did in terms of Jim Morrison, trying to get into that space to play that part.
Oh, yeah, exactly. He spent years, or sorry, he spent a year, like really kind of taking all this time to lose himself and create the role. And even Jennifer Tilly, in a remembrance here after Val had passed, said that like we were all sitting there, a bunch of us waiting to audition for the movie in what was just one step above a cattle call. He showed up, drove right up in front of the casting office, parked his car right in front of the casting office, jumped out of the car without any shoes on, walked right on in, and we all knew this was Jim Morrison. Like she said, we didn't even, there was no question at all anymore that he had kind of channeled him. And the thing is, I think it was Oliver Stone or a couple of the producers didn't really see him as Morrison. It wasn't until the Doors producer got the video that Val had recorded of himself singing one of the Doors songs. I think it's Paul Rothschild. He's the one that said, no. This is the guy. You got to look at this guy. I was with Jim. This guy is channeling Jim. And that's how he ended up getting the leg up to get the part as well. So these are things that happen in interesting, mystical ways that put you in a position. And look, Oliver Stone needed someone to play Jim Morrison. I don't think there's any actor that we knew at the time that could have taken on the role and did it as believably as Val Kilmer did, where you're to like, this guy is channeling him. It's no longer, it's not like Anthony Hopkins and Nixon where you're trying to force your brain to see Nixon.
Right.
He has literally become Jim Morrison. And as you're watching it on the screen, you're living through the things that he's going through. I do agree with you. The film falls apart because as usually most of Oliver Stone's films from that point forward kind of fell apart in the third act because they kind of just go all over the place instead of being much more stronger in the overall narrative they're trying to tell. But his performance comes through and blazes through. And here are the five people who were nominated that year, Steve. Anthony Hopkins for Silence of the Lambs, Warren Beatty for Bugsy, Robert De Niro for Cape Fear, Nick Nolte for The Prince of Tides, and Robin Williams for The Fisher King. There is no way that you can't take out Nick Nolte from that damn list and put in Val Kilmer. Now, does he win? Probably not. I think Hopkins still wins because that's an iconic role. And in a better movie, but I think he absolutely deserved to be nominated over Nick Nolte. No one talks about that performance from The Prince and if Tides outside of Nick Nolte's family, maybe Barbara Streisand's family. So,
I totally agree. And you add to that the fact that really, as great as Anthony Hopkins is, that should be a supporting actor because he's only on screen for like 10 minutes or 15 minutes or something. Whereas Jim Morrison, I mean, that's the lead of that movie by far. Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you there.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
From there, with Val, we go on to Thunderheart, which is one of my favorite films. I don't know if you've ever seen this, Steve, but he got top billing over Sam Shepard at the time. Sam Shepard was a name at the time as an actor, as a playwright, as, of course, as well. But he got top billing. And this one is a really interesting Native American movie. Val Kilmer's dad had some Cherokee blood in him. So there's probably a desire and a connection to this. Plus, as you said, he's an artsy fartsy guy. And certainly people who are in are driven by creative impulses certainly find themselves at times exploring Native American things, Native American art, Native American stories. And so this is an exploration of how the government is messing with a reservation. And I think it's a fascinating story because he initially is rejecting his Indian roots, his Native American roots, his connection to those roots, because he just wants to focus on being the cop or the federal agent who's trying to find out what's going on here. And then as the film progresses, he starts to realize how much of this is actually true versus what the federal government has been telling him. And then he starts to embrace his Native American roots. It's a fantastic film. Graham Greene is in this one as well. So, you know, if you guys haven't seen Thunderheart, I highly recommend watching it because it's a great performance from Val as well. Did you ever see this one, Steve?
You know what's crazy is I have to have seen it. I read the book. I remember reading the book in college. It's actually from a series of books. I read several of them. And yeah. I can remember the movie coming out. And I can remember going, oh, I read this book. I can't wait to go see this movie. I love Val Kilmer. I have zero memory of the movie at all. So it is possible I haven't seen it. But my brain just goes like, I must have seen it. I mean, have seen this. What year did it come out?
92, I believe. So 1 year after The Doors. Yeah, 92.
Yeah, I must have seen it. I can't imagine I didn't. I have zero memory of it. So there you go.
Yeah, directed by Michael Apted. Fred Ward was in as well, and Fred Thompson. So a good, strong cast here. In its approach to that story, which I thought was a fantastic thing to watch at the time. And also showed that, like, this is what also, let's just stop here at 1992. What an interesting collection of movies, right? Top Secret, Real Genius, Willow, Top Gun, The Doors, and here we go into Thunderheart. Certainly, this is not your typical movie star resume if they want to become a global superstar. This is a guy who marched to a completely different drum, was inspired by things that grabbed his attention, things that he wanted to do, and different in his approach, which I think is the beginning of people like quietly starting to appreciate him as a talent, that he's not driven just to be a global superstar. He's driven by things that actually spark his creative juices, you know? And so they don't always work, but they're the things that he is inspired to do, so to speak.
Well, that's kind of what I mean by the artsy temperament is that he wants to follow his whatever, you know, and I saw this in the documentary, and I'm sure you'll get into when it, you know, he goes back to painting and things like that. But it's like it's the artistic whim. Oh, this is interesting. Let me explore this thing all the way back to the play in Juilliard, you know, that they developed together. Yeah. You know, it's like that really is antithetical to being a Hollywood movie star.
Right.
Being a Hollywood movie star is not following your artistic whim wherever it takes you. That's not how it works.
Right. Exactly. That's the important thing to understand when you're driven by the creative, or important to understand the people that are driven by the creative spirit, because they just have their own approach to it, and they'll walk their own path no matter what anyone tells them to do. You know, and certainly Val had that as well. And next up for him, you've got True Romance. If you remember him as the quote mentor, and he essentially is playing Elvis. We never actually see his face, but it's his voice. And we see him like out of focus in the mirror there when Christian Slater's character is talking to him. I remember that being a big deal, and him working with Tony Scott again, who of course he had done Top Gun with. Then there's a weird film like Real McCoy with Kim Basinger that I don't think that was great. And then, boom, we have Tombstone, man. I mean, Doc Holliday, it's really interesting to have a career where numerous characters could be your signature character. And he has that. Well, already at this point, early in his career, Iceman, Jim Morrison, and you could argue Mad Mardigan. And now here we go with his version of Doc Holliday. And people maybe forget it was competing with another version of Wyatt Earp. And that is the one with Kevin Costner and Dennis Quaid. did his version of Doc Holliday, and I thought it was pretty incredible. But there was something iconic about Val Kilmer's approach to Doc Holliday. So what are your thoughts about Tombstone now, and what are your thoughts on his performance in that movie?
And first of all, it's always weird when there's two competing versions of the same thing. You know, it's like the Deep Impact Armageddon moment and stuff like that, where it's like, oh, we can watch this and compare. The thing that's interesting to me, they're two entirely different movies, two entirely different styles, both of which I think don't succeed completely. And both of which, the best part is the Doc Holliday's. Dennis Quaid is fantastic as Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp in that big, sprawling, kind of boring movie. Yes. And Tombstone, which is like the opposite film, which is like a fun, silly popcorn thing. Right. Again, I mean, to say that he steals the show with every freaking moment. And to me, I actually think, you know, it's interesting tracking his career. Because to me, I go, I love him in Top Secret and in Real Genius. I love him in Top Gun, although it's a movie you love more than I do. But I actually think Jim Morrison and Doc Holliday, if those had been his career and not those, and not Willow, not Top Gun, not those, that actually is more the direction of the kind of actor he was capable of being.
Because
those are the character actor roles. Those are the roles where he's going to jump in with both feet. Like I was saying, that was in the doc, was that to do the death scene of Doc Holliday with Kurt Russell, he had he had a bed of ice under the bed, so he would be freezing and shivering. And it's like, that's full method shit. You know what I mean? Like, that is the full, I am in, and he's in like this popcorn Western movie, but he's acting the hell out of the damn thing. And that's where it's like, I just keep going back to this. Oh man, maybe if he wasn't so great looking and slightly less of a movie star, he would have had a career that was more the career that he wanted than the career that he ended up having.
Yeah, but I don't think he would have been able to play Jim Morrison. I think he would have had to have.
True.
I think it's the deal with the devil, right? He was blessed with these incredible looks, the arguably movie star Hollywood handsome looks. But he was also born with the soul of an imp in a way, and of a creative spirit, a creative rebellious spirit. And I look at people like, as we said before in our Paul Newman, Robert Redford exploit, like Paul Newman has some of that. Brad Pitt has some of that. And I think there's a certain kind of love we have for actors who are incredibly good looking, but they pursue things that they wouldn't, that other actors who look like them wouldn't. And it's a joy to see that with Val, and it helps you to appreciate him. But he does. And then Tombstone, yes, I agree with you. It is a popcorn. It is a McDonald's Big Mac of a Western. It's really like you eat it and then you forget about it. But like, you remember Val Kilmer in the movie. Kurt Russell's great as well, I think, in the film. But the film itself is so lightweight and just ridiculous and stupid. And at times just kind of whatever, but his performance is what you remember, and his rhythms, his cadence. I mean, just the little things of swinging to make fun. You know, these are these little rebellious things that I believe he came up with on the set as an actor. Even within a Western, he is making fun of the Western, right? The idea of being able to swing your gun and all of this. So there's a genius in that doesn't come off as pretentious. It comes off as endearing, and that's another element of his performance as well.
Well, just to add quickly to your analogy, which I think is perfect, is that sometimes what you really want is a McDonald's Big Mac, and that is absolutely delicious at that moment.
Yes.
You know, so there's I don't disparage Big Macs, but we should acknowledge when a Big Mac is a Big Mac, you know.
I agree. And that one came in a big old school styrofoam container, that's for sure. After this, he does something called Wings of Courage, which I had never even heard of, but it is a theatrical a release here from Jean-Jacques Annaud is the director, who would do a number of other films as well. And it's he plays a really small role in it as Jean Mermoz in this. It's a Craig Sheffer, Elizabeth McGovern film. So kind of an interesting decision to make at this point in his career. But again, he's willing to do other things that he wouldn't normally do. And then we have the 1-2-3 punch. Here we go, which is very interesting, Steve. You could argue that this is the peak of Val Kilmer. And then after this, quickly after this, in the same year, we achieve the peak of Val Kilmer and then the beginning of the descent of Val Kilmer, because we have Batman Forever, Heat, and The Island of Dr. Moreau that come out in, in a year, I guess, a year and a half there with Batman Forever, The Heat, and then The Island of Dr. Moreau in 1996. So what are your thoughts looking back on him as Batman in the role of Bruce Wayne opposite Nicole Kidman and Jim Carrey and Tommy Lee Jones in this Joel Schumacher movie?
I'm going to go back to a statement I made many, many years. It might have been at the very beginning. I might have said this in our Superman episode of The Cinephiles, like, which is our third episode or something, which is that I will contend, and I believe I still feel that this is true, that the actor playing Batman has never been the problem with any of the Batman movies. All of them are fine. It's all the other stuff around them that is the problem. And I think, you know, Joel Schumacher coming onto this movie, it's not as bad as the next one's going to be.
Yeah.
But it's not good. I mean, I haven't seen it in 25 years. And so I maybe someday I'll go back to do it. But Val Kilmer is fine. It's not, there's nothing that Val Kilmer is doing that is wrong about playing Batman. But I also know he should never have taken that gig. Of all of the gigs that he took, like, this is where I actually blame him. I don't, you know, if he didn't like being in Top Secret, you know, that was your first movie. You can take a gig, but you're an established movie star and you're going to get in the rubber suit and you think that's going to make you happy as a performer or you're going to feel good about it. It is not. I think it was a huge mistake for him to take the gig.
You're probably right. But I also think, again, as the impish, rebellious guy, sometimes you want to take the front-facing role and see what you can do with it, see what you can bring to it. And I think especially with the way it was pitched to him, which is a campy version of Batman, this might have brought him back to the Adam West days.
Right.
And maybe he felt he was doing like a version of Batman with the Adam West. Because I think of the scene where Dr. Meridian Chase, I think that's Nicole Kidman's character's name, turns Batman down because she says she's met Bruce Wayne and she loves Bruce Wayne. And Batman, he goes, well, that's a good guy. And he turns around and in close up in the camera, you see Batman do this big shit eating grin on his face before he jumps out of the her place. And that would never have happened with another Batman. And the fact that it happens with his Batman, I think, adds to maybe what was the interest there. But I hear you. It may not have been the wisest choice career-wise for him. And look, a lot of people loved that movie at the time. I tried to watch it again a few months ago. Oof, it is a chore to get through. It is not a good movie. I do enjoy Jim Carrey. I enjoy Tommy Lee Jones. I enjoy Val and Nicole. But there's a lot of weird shit in that movie. And you have Drew Barrymore and Debbie Mazar playing just like add-ons, which is so weird to think about considering how great they were in other roles and in their careers. But it's an interesting thing. And of course, it's all overshadowed by Jim Carrey. You don't even remember that, like, that Val Kilmer's not even the standout performance of that movie.
Right.
And that's sad to see. So I think your point you were making earlier as I'm talking, I'm kind of maybe weaving my way back to what you said, because Val is a standout actor. He is not to be overshadowed. And so why would you take this role on when you're playing the straight man to everyone else's more outlandish character? I would have loved to have seen his Two-Face or
literally going to say the same thing. That's literally what I was about to say. Or the Joker. He could be the Joker too. Like it would be fantastic. There he's not wasted. What's so funny, and we could go on this digression forever, but because I worked in a comics book store in 89 when Batman came out.
Right.
And so I was right in the midst of this, of geekdom. I could have been on the Geek Buddies back in 1989. I was very up on all that stuff. I couldn't be on it now. But at that time, I remember the excitement and I remember the geek anger about Bruce Wayne revealing himself to Vicki Vale. And then the second one comes out and there's the, you know, little controversy. And then this one comes out and now, because I'm, you know, hooked into all sorts of guys. Yeah. Literally was working in Work in Progress studio where we were where Jeff and Steve were drawing comics and I was trying to break into comics as a writer. We're going downstairs to the comic book store all the time. I'm really hooked into that world and hearing back then what would evolve 30 years later into the geek wars we hear today. It just occurred to me that movie is like the origin of geeks starting to feel powerful and disagreeing about the direction. Should Batman be dark and brooding like Frank Miller, or should it be fun and campy like Adam West and Joel Schumacher wants it to be?
Right.
And geeks were outraged at the time by the things that were going on and the directions they were going. And then when you get the nipples on George Clooney's costume and all of the insanity in the next movie, like this is where it's like, this is the origin story for geek rage, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe there's something that he's, you know, maybe there's a, I don't know, maybe there's a desire to self-punish, to take on a role like this. Cause I was just reading, apparently he didn't know who was going to be directing and he didn't have a script. He just said yes before any of that. So my theory that he could have taken it because it was campy and wanted to maybe evoke the Adam West thing goes right out the window. He didn't know any of this stuff, according to some of the things we're reading here. And here's who was in contention above him and was slated to take the role: William Baldwin, who people forget was a big deal in the early 90s because of Backdraft and a couple other roles. So, you know, he was someone who was looked at as a possibility to step in to play Bruce Wayne. So William Baldwin's Batman to Val Kilmer's Two-Face or Riddler, I think that's the more interesting movie to watch, because you're wasting Val in something like Bruce Wayne slash Batman. And even the New York Times' Janet Maslin said Kilmer was a poor successor to Keaton. Bob Kane said in a Cinescape interview that all of the actors who have played Batman up to that point, he did feel that Kilmer gave the best interpretation. Maltin complimented Kilmer's portrayal when he reviewed the film, but he did not return for another Batman, feeling the Batman was being marginalized in favor of the villains and because of scheduling problems with the Saint, which is why George Clooney took on the role. So what about now? Let's move on to Heat. Now, what are your thoughts on his work in Heat here with Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, yet still finding a way to stand out in his own way? What do you think about his work in Heat, as we see in the top corner there as Chris here from Val Kilmer?
I think he's flawless. I really do. I think this is where, and it's funny, all the things we've been talking about of like, how does he, part of what we've been discussing, which is interesting to me, is how does he fit into the movie? How does he find himself? How does he find the right place to be? And in the case of Tombstone, he 100% understood what to do in that film. And I think the same is true in Heat. And I think in some ways this is among the best movies he ever did. I mean, this is an incredibly good film, and he is playing a fully realized, extremely complex, because he is charismatic and interesting and talented. He's loyal to Robert De Niro's character. He's deeply in love with it's Ashley Judd, right?
Ashley Judd, yes.
Yeah, he's deeply in love with her. He's also not in control, abusive, dangerous, and all of those things are playing in this character. And I think in terms of one of the things that Heat is about, because what Heat asks you to do is say, here are a bunch of criminals who are capable of being stone cold murderers. They will kill innocent people to get what they want, and yet you are going to feel like they're a family and you're going to really like them. And he's the eldest son, essentially, of De Niro. And so, like, you have deep personal feelings towards this person who you probably shouldn't like for a lot of reasons, and yet you're continually drawn to them. I think his performance is stellar.
I think it is the what do they call it when they this is it. This is a role that boils Val Kilmer down to his essence.
Yeah.
He is incredible. I would say that this is probably the most incredibly attractive he is in all of his roles, with the longer hair, the swagger. He's in his full-on manhood. There's an edginess to him that's really threatening and unsettling. As you say, when he's having his back and forth with Ashley Judd, when he's angry at her, throwing shit at the wall, coming close to slapping her and beating her up, like, it's really unsettling. But you see also that he is this lost soul. He's this kid. And so this father figure of Robert De Niro, who essentially, as you said, he's seeing him maybe as oldest son, like, he is trying to mentor him, but Chris can't do the things that Robert De Niro's character can do. He doesn't have the strength to just be able to drop stuff at 30 seconds or whatever if the heat's around the corner because of his love for Ashley, because of his love for that, for Ashley's character. And so you see that in the movie. So you want to take care of him. You want him to make the right decisions. You want him to not be this abusive guy at times. You want him to not be, because he is in service of the peace. Yet when he is dialed in, he is ruthless. So he's great at his job, but he's also a caring, vulnerable person, even all the way up until the end when she gives him the sign to go away. You're heartbroken for him because in some messed up way, you want them to end up together, because even though she's been cheating on him, she still loves him. And so in some messed up way, you want them to be together. And I think this is the most Val Kilmer of all the Val Kilmer roles. And it comes through so honestly, because you just want to take care of Chris and you feel bad for Chris throughout the movie. At least I do. And I think that's what I love about his performance. So how do you stand out when you've got two master actors leaning into their badassery? You're the guy at the heart of it, who's got the real emotion, who's going through the things he's going through. Listen, I don't buy a thing of what Pacino is doing with Diane Benora. No offense. Or is it? Yeah, I think it's Benora or Michelle Forbes. I don't buy a thing that he's doing in the connection. When he's making out with her, it's like weird, it's awkward. The stuff with Natalie Portman, certainly touching, and I believe that. But they're both driven to do the things that they do. Chris is much more of an open wound, and he's a fascinating performance in the film, stands out so well because of his talent, you know?
I agree. I mean, it's, I hadn't thought about the De Niro stuff that you mentioned, but I do think he knew where to be. He knew how to hold his space.
Yes.
And what's interesting too is that he's never trying to go up against De Niro. Mm-mm. He's not trying to outsize more Sizemore. You know what I mean? He's just like, this is my role. This is what I have to do. It's so funny because I know we're going to move into the island of Dr. Moreau. Yeah, and it's there's sort of, and it's funny that you mentioned Two-Face, because there are different Val Kilmers. And there's the Val Kilmer that is engaged in artistic work that he finds fulfilling and challenging. And there is the Val Kilmer who is not. Right. And I am a fan of one of those guys. And I'm not so much a fan of the other one.
Well, I hear you. But I think you can't have one without the other. That's the thing. Sadly,
I agree. No, people are human people. Beings,
we are slaves to the different versions of ourselves that we present at different moments in our life. And I would argue this is Val, like in the mid-90s, this is Val feeling himself. He is absolutely this swaggering cock of a human as an actor. And he's picking these bigger roles, and you know, getting into Heat was amazing. Michael Mann said, "I always marveled at the range, the brilliant variability within the powerful current of Val's possessing and expressing character." That's a phenomenal description of Val Kilmer as an actor working in that movie Heat. But as you said, Steve, after that movie, we move on to the island of Dr. Moreau, and there's a shot with a full-on swagger. And this is where you get, like, the artist rebelling against the movie star, right? And throughout this whole process with what goes on with Richard Stanley, with what goes down with John Frankenheimer, and then with Brando, here he is going from De Niro to Brando, right? He's almost being blessed as the next Brando / De Niro by working with these two guys back to back. But this is the film that kind of breaks Val Kilmer, gets him a bad reputation, and then from here it's a bit of law of diminishing returns. So do you remember watching this movie? Have you seen the documentary on this movie? And what were your thoughts on the scenes in Val where it's very clear how much swagger he has on the set and all the things that they went through on that set?
So this was a legendary shit show, I think. Oh, yeah. And I had heard about it long before. I do not think I saw the movie in the theater. I have definitely seen the movie. And watching the movie, first of all, just putting aside like the behind the scenes and all the other stuff.
Yeah.
Watching the movie, you're just like, how did this happen? Like, how did this train wreck? Because it is so heinous a film. Yeah. Like, it is so awful. And you're watching Brando, who many would put as the greatest film actor in the history of film actors.
Yeah.
Val Kilmer, a great actor. And you're watching them just like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, what is going on? What is this movie? And yes, I have seen the documentary about the making of the film. I don't I honestly, it was a while ago. I honestly couldn't trace the insanity that happened in this movie, but much of it, you know, most of it is not either Val Kilmer or Brando's fault. It's there's all these other things going on. But then when things in my memory, as things start to go south, the personalities of Brando, and I get it, like you've worked for a terrible boss. Sure. I've worked in for a terrible boss. We've both worked in situations. We've both been in plays or things where we knew it was bad.
Yeah.
And it,
yeah.
and it's real hard. And I haven't been in a thing that I knew was bad 1,000 miles away on a desert island with, you know, like that kind of craziness. So it is hard to keep your eyes on the prize and continue to show up and do good work. But man, they did not continue to show up and do good work. And the amount that they contributed, both Val and Marlon, to the insanity of that project is a lot. And this is where I was deeply moved by the artsy guy who I watched in the documentary and the way they presented him. They didn't spend a lot of time talking about this particular movie in that documentary. But the downside of that artsy, sometimes mercurial, following your own vision thing is you can be a real prick on the set if things aren't going your way. And I don't like that. You know what I mean? Like I have a real, and again, this movie was a shit show. It was a shit show for a ton of reasons that were not Val Kilmer, but you showed up to do the job, you signed the contract. And when your name is at the top or near the top of the call sheet, that's a responsibility to everybody else that's there for you to show up and do your job. I get that it was shitty. It sounds like it was fucking terrible. But I don't, but from my memory of what his behavior was like on that set, it's not cool.
Well, I think, fair. And I think he's clearly an actor who needed a strong hand in the director's chair in order to deliver great work. And I don't think that he had that with Richard Stanley. And when John Frankenheimer came in, who was so much like a military sergeant type approach to it, I think that made him bristle even more and made him rebel. That sparked the rebellious a thing within him as well. And, you know, I had a chance to interview Richard Stanley on the Deep Cut when he was promoting Color Out of Space. We had an interview and talked a little bit about the Val Kilmer stuff, but we were only able to talk about officially stuff on the podcast that was very limited. But after, I had some really off-the-record conversations about his experiences with Val. And he was very complimentary of Val Kilmer, very complimentary. The rumors are that they battled or whatever. And he's like, yeah, we had our fights because I marched to a different drum artistically than he marched, but we had different points of views. And so blah, blah, blah. But he was very clear that Val was a person he appreciated in retrospect after the dust was settled. The thing with Frankenheimer, he said this, I think he said, yeah, as soon as he shouted cut on the final scene, he yelled out, now get that bastard off my set about Val Kilmer. So it was not a good reaction. But then you also have Brando, who's polluting everything as well with his version of essentially what Val Kilmer was doing. So if the dad on the set, which is Marlon Brando, is acting like this a-hole, then the son is going to follow suit sometimes. So it doesn't remove blame. And I think you're right to feel that way, of course, Steve, about that kind of stuff, because no one wants to deal with that. But it's such an unusually crazy set. And that documentary is mind-blowing, because if Richard Stanley was hiding out as one of the extras in the animal outfit the whole time, that's just insane to even consider once he was fired off the film. It's nuts. So it's a legendary film. From here, we get something called Dead Girl, which I don't know much about, but then The Ghost in the Darkness, The Saint, and then one of my favorites, Steve, The Prince of Egypt. So I think Ghost in the Darkness is kind of one of those forgotten mid-90s films with him and Michael Douglas. I think it's based on the book. And then you have The Saint, which was his attempt to maybe go back and right the wrongs of Batman Forever and lead his own franchise. So clearly during this time, Steve, there is this battle between the artist and the guy who wants to become the movie star still coursing through him. And The Saint was, it's a fun guilty pleasure. It's not that great of a movie. Him and Elizabeth Shue have some nice chemistry, but you got to see Val Kilmer essentially be like Flo in the Progressive Insurance commercials and do all these different characters. And maybe this was his you know, before Tom, well, I guess Mission Impossible is just a couple of years later. So maybe he's predating Tom Cruise by a couple of years before Tom starts putting on the faces in Mission Impossible. So it was an interesting decision. What are your, we'll leave Prince of Egypt for a separate thing. What are your thoughts on Ghost of Darkness and Ghost of the Darkness and the Saint? Any thoughts on that?
I mean, there's just a lot of, for me, there's a lot of disappointment in Val Kilmer's career. And the Saint is a movie, you know, because I had seen some of it's based on the Roger Moore TV series, and I'd watched some of that, and I love that sort of 60s spy fun sort of things, you know, that
for sure.
I like that genre. I remember going to see it and going, well, that was fine, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not, you know, I like the idea that that hey, Val Kilmer can play with his sort of character-ness of doing that, you know, but I don't think the movies, there is a reason why there isn't The Saint 2, you know, it just doesn't have that thing to it. Ghost of the Darkness, I remember, because at that point I knew who William Goldman, the screenwriter, was. You know, this is Princess Bride and Misery and All the President's Men and all sorts of great films. So when I saw this movie and I saw the trailer, and I think it's Michael Douglas, right? Is that the other?
Michael Douglas.
Super excited about it. And I don't think that movie's terribly good at all. No. So this is sort of where, I mean, we've had, and as I think I said in my our discussion of Heat, at the time that he came out, I was in the middle of film school and was very judgmental about it and didn't like it. So for me, like, Val Kilmer had gone from The Doors, Tombstone, which I liked, and then we have a lot, Batman, and we've got a lot of movies that I didn't really like so much, including Island of Dr. Moreau. So I'm seeing, for me, at this point in the 90s, it feels like Val's a bit in the wilderness.
Yeah, you know? I think he does go into the wilderness with occasional bright moments, but overall, these are kind of middling films, maybe B-minus to C-level films that don't really do much for him as an actor. Prince of Egypt, he's incredible in Prince of Egypt. I love him as Moses. Him and Ralph Fiennes offered a really beautiful tribute to him, and I think the film will take even more resonance for me when I watch it again and think of it, because I'm not strong enough to watch it again right now, because I'll just be a ball of emotions crying all over the place. And I already am when I watch that movie, so even more so now. But I think his Moses is maybe my favorite Moses ever. And I just recently rewatched The Ten Commandments because it's free on YouTube. I watched the whole movie the other day. And
How is it?
I would love for us to do it on the Cinephiles, you and I, but I think it's going to be a hell of a thing once we can, because it's not as good as I remember it being, yet I can't deny the majesty of Charlton Heston as Moses, and I can't deny the over-the-top cheesiness of Yul Brynner as Ramses and everyone else involved in it, but it is a beautiful movie. I watched it on my Oculus,
Wow.
And it was a stellar experience to watch it and marvel at the majesty, because it has YouTube app on that thing, so I can watch it. But I was just like, oh, this isn't as good as I remember when I was a kid, but we have to do it, because I think there were so many discussions and fun moments, especially Edward G. Robinson. What the hell is he doing in a Moses movie? But like, there's so much for us to discuss in that. But Val Kilmer's Moses is just, it's fantastic. It's, and you sense the brotherhood. Him and Ralph Fiennes really established the tragedy of the loss of their brotherhood in that movie so well through their voiceover work. And it is phenomenal. I put this up there with Doc Holliday and with Chris and Mad Mardigan and all the Doors, all of these roles. His role as Moses, I think, belongs in the same breath as all those people, because that is a very difficult role to do on screen and make it connectable and make it believable and make it something that moves you emotionally, you know?
You know, I've only seen it once.
What?
I saw it. Yeah, I saw it in the Cinerama Dome. I can remember going to see it. Yeah. I can remember loving it. I can remember going like, wow, this is really, really great. And it was sort of, because is it a DreamWorks animated movie?
Yeah, DreamWorks Animation. Yes.
Yeah, because this is sort of the beginning of DreamWorks, and DreamWorks, can DreamWorks compete with Disney? Can they compete with Pixar? And I remember watching and going like, yeah, this is special. I really, really liked it. I've heard you and Vogel talk about it for years. I've heard you like sing duets and shit from this.
Yes. Yeah.
But I've never seen it since.
I mean, it's an all-star cast, because you got Ralph Fiennes, I said, Sandra Bullock, Michelle Pfeiffer, who, by the way, had worked with Val Kilmer way back in the early 1980s. Jeff Goldblum, Danny Glover, Helen Mirren, Patrick Stewart, Steve Martin, Martin Short, James Avery, who are all part of the cast. And the songs are beautiful and really well done. And I think it was nominated for an Oscar for the song When You Believe with Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston. So, yeah, it's one of these things that is one of these films that people don't bring up when they talk about Val Kilmer enough, but it is an incredibly well done animated film with a fantastic performance from him. But as you say, Steve, we get into these weird, we go At First Sight, Joe the King. He has a small part in Pollock, which was the Ed Harris film that won Oscars. Red Planet, The Salt and Sea, as I mentioned, Hard Cash, Masked and Anonymous. He plays the porn star John Holmes in Wonderland. He has a small part in The Missing, the Ron Howard Western with Cate Blanchett and Tommy Lee Jones, Blind Horizon. And then, as I said earlier, the David Mamet film Spartan, which I think is one of these rare, fantastic films in this wilderness of his career, as you said, Steve. Stateside, Mindhunters, George and the Dragon. He does an episode of The Entourage. He plays Alexander's dad in the Oliver Stone Alexander film. And it's such a, I mean, this is such a weird thing for him to do, but maybe because he owed Oliver, he was in it.
I don't know. That movie's weird, man. That is not a good film.
Yeah, and so there's a wilderness, and then something happens in 2005, Steve, which I think makes people remember Val Kilmer and fall back in love with him, and that's when he plays Gay Perry in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, opposite Robert Downey Jr. with Shane Black and Michelle Monaghan in the movie as well. So, and this is one of my also favorite Val Kilmer films. What are your thoughts on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang? And that was 20 years ago. What are your thoughts on that?
First of all, that's crazy that it's 20 years ago.
I know, bro.
Second of all, I remember seeing it in the theater, and it is one I rewatched. I watched it about a week ago. Totally holds up, enjoyable. And it's so funny. I mean, it's sad thinking about it now because, Robert Downey Jr., this is a comeback for both of them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, this is like, oh, here are these two actors who were both supremely talented. Yeah. Both their careers didn't go the direction that we thought they would go.
Yeah.
They come in and do this movie that was, I think, really unique for that era of being a fun, kind of noir-y, kind of a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but exciting and thrilling with that great Shane Black, script and all of that stuff, and going like, oh, I love both these guys. And Robert Downey Jr. goes and does Iron Man and becomes the highest paid actor maybe in the history of the world. I don't know. Probably is. And Val Kilmer, kind of moseys along. And it's a bummer because he's great in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And he is fantastic in the film. I mean, you look at these guys right at the time in their career, you could argue that this rivals a little bit of Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer, because that Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer and Top Gun is at the beginning of their careers. This is the beginning of the potential comeback of both of these 80s actors, because people forget Robert Downey Jr. was in a lot of movies in the 1980s, was a cast member of SNL for a whole year. And so this is the beginning of a comeback for both of these guys potentially, but only really Robert Downey Jr. takes the comeback and goes somewhere with it, because after this movie, and I agree with you, look, the lines here are incredible. Val has a confidence. He's playing a gay character, which I think is great. That's not something they make a big deal about, but there are certain moments and certain back and forths I think are hilarious, and he plays with them so well. And he's endearing, and he's sweet, and he gets to enact vengeance on the man who raped the young woman in the film, which I think is a great moment when he slaps that old man, who is the old man from Saving Private Ryan at the end there. It's a great moment between them, and Val carries it off with aplomb, absolute aplomb. And so you think, okay, here we go. It's Val coming back, but unfortunately another bout into the wilderness, something called 10th and Wolf, played Moscow Zero, Summer of Love, Deja Vu. He does the 10 Commandments, the musical, and comes back to voice over Moses again and sing the songs, an episode of Numbers, three episodes of a miniseries, Comanche Moon, West Texas Children's Story, Conspiracy, Delgo, Columbus Day, what that is, The Love Guru, why are you in that movie, Felon, 222, something called The Conspiracy, Stream Experiment. He's the voice of Kit in the Knight Rider reboot show for 18 episodes in 2008.
Wow. So I didn't know that.
And I go, look, whatever people, I mean, sometimes coming in to do a fun voiceover gig is totally fun. And maybe he liked it and it was great. And maybe he would love the original series.
Yeah, he grew up on the original series. Maybe, yeah.
Maybe those things are all true. And I hope that's the case. But I didn't know that, and it makes me sad to hear.
You know? Right. Streets of Blood, American Cowslip, The Thaw. And then he does a film that I liked, which was Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, with him and Nicolas Cage. You want to enjoy two crazy actors being crazy for 2 hours with Eva Mendes? Then please watch Port of Call, New Orleans, because they're both out-crazying each other throughout, which I think is a blast to see with them. Hardwired, Double Identity, Bloodworth. Then he has a fun role in MacGruber, playing Kunth there, the villain in the movie there. And then The Traveler, The Gun, Kill the Irishman, which was a Ray Stevenson vehicle, I think based on a true story. 5 Days of War, Blood Out. He does the voice of Dr. Walker Sloan in a Spider-Man video game in 2011. Then he plays Wyatt Earp in a weird short, Wyatt Earp's Revenge. 7 Below, Breathless. Standing Up, Life. Then he does an episode of Life's Too Short, which is hilarious, that Ricky Gervais or Warwick Davis series, where he keeps putting on the Batman mask and no one knows who he is and no one remembers that he played Batman. He voices a character in Planes, and then does some stuff for Robot Chicken, does an episode of Psych, and then we have the throat cancer. And so the roles start to now become things that you have to voice over, and there's not really much of note that he does. He does become a blunt man in the Jay and Silent Bob reboot. He does a Terrence Malick film, Song to Song. But it's really when he reappears just a couple of years ago as Iceman again in Top Gun Maverick that people had a massive outpouring of love for him and a remembrance of the greatness of Val Kilmer. And that scene was so well acted, so well done, so well written. And it was a scene that was very meta within a film. And as you said earlier, Steve, which is a really interesting point you bring up, we can make the connection. You said, well, Tom Cruise isn't Maverick and Val Kilmer isn't Iceman, but their animus that was naturally there as because of who they were as actors, now we see them all these years later as friends, hugging and caring for each other, and still with the ball-busting moment at the end of who's actually the better pilot. And I think it's a beautiful epitaph to his career, which he unknowingly did there as one of the final moments of his life on screen.
It's an amazing moment. I think it's one of those weird moments in film. And I hadn't thought about it when I was saying that about Top Gun, but you're totally right. It's this weird moment in film where we're watching a movie, and we're in the movie, we're watching the characters of Maverick and Iceman while simultaneously watching the real people of Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer.
Yes.
And
yes.
Our emotional reaction to it is filled up with both of those things. And in particular, the fact that we know that Val Kilmer is ill. And what's interesting about it, it's actually perfectly not analogous, because the story in the movie is the story of the successful person who became an admiral.
Yes.
And the other guy who couldn't get his shit together and still a captain or whatever his rank is in this and is fucked up. And yet they both have mutual respect for him. And in the reality is you have the guy who's arguably the most consistently successful movie star in history, you know, literally a career that goes from the 80s to the 2020s. And he's still starring in huge movies. There's nobody like that in history with a guy who, you know, maybe he fucked up his career a little bit. Maybe he made some bad choices. Maybe he just got really unlucky, depending on how you want to look at the story. And they're playing the reverse of that, which is really, really interesting. I think it's really, really powerful. I think it shows genuinely, but I think here's how I'll put it. I think Tom Cruise both showed genuine love and affection for Val Kilmer and also had a deep and, one might say, cynical understanding of what he needed to make his movie successful. Do you know what I mean? Like both things can be true at the same time.
Yeah, but I do think there is, and I know that I may be in trouble for saying this, but I think there is a Tom Cruise that is having a lot of perspective and about his life now. He's an older man now. The time is running out where he's going to be the action star and he's going to have to transition into other things. And maybe there are some scores to settle as he realizes a closure to have rather as he realizes he's getting close to the end of his life. And I think the movie really radiates that. There's an energy to that movie of like correcting past mistakes and confronting old wounds and trying to heal from the old wounds and do better. And you know, all of that. And so I hear you, but I also think it fits the overall theme of the movie.
Totally.
One of redemption, which I think really works as well. And Tom Cruise was at CinemaCon just a few weeks ago, or just a couple of weeks ago, 10 days ago here. And when he was presenting new material for Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, he took a moment before he started to lead the audience in a moment of silence for Val Kilmer, who had just died 2 days earlier. He said, "I'd like to take a moment before we get started today to honor a dear friend of mine, Val Kilmer. I can't tell you how much I admired his work and him as a human being, how grateful and honored I was that he joined Top Gun and came back for Top Gun Maverick. I think it would be really nice if we could just have a moment all together and just take a moment because he loved movies and he gave to a lot of us with his performance in those films. If we could just all take a moment and just think about all the wonderful times that we had with him. Thank you, Val. I wish you well on your next journey. Thank you all for doing that. I know he appreciates." So it was a very beautiful tribute. And what Jeff said on the hot mic is the rumors that he had heard is that they were going to announce a Top Gun 3 at CinemaCon, but felt that because of the passing of Val Kilmer, it wasn't the right time. So I don't know how much of that is true, but it shows an incredible amount of respect for him and his passing. If it is true that you don't announce the third installment of this franchise that has all of a sudden found new life this late in its existence, you know, so it's amazing stuff here. So I know some of you might say, well, we didn't talk about Mark Twain or his theater work, but this, you know, we're the cinephiles. We talk about the movies and that's what we focus on. And so I hope you all appreciated this walk through his career. Steve, as we're wrapping up before we get to the Streamlabs and Super Chats, any thoughts you want to get across now before we get into some of these questions?
I think I just am returning back to the thing that I said at the beginning, which is the contrast between the movie star actor guy and this artsy human guy that I really experienced through watching the documentary, which I do highly recommend.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of, you know, maybe this is just an important thing to say, is to continue to remind ourselves that these big famous people that live these glamorous lives and are so beautiful and charismatic and charming and talented,
yeah,
are just human beings, just like us, who are just as lost and confused and make bad decisions and make the right decisions for the wrong reasons and the wrong decisions for the right reasons. And they're just like us. And, you know, Val is a human being, you know, that's the big thing I'm thinking about right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I love him more than just for his roles, like just who he was as a person. It's something that moves me and touches me for sure. Let's hear from some of you all what you think. It's Scal Scalise's in there with two of these super chats. He says, "Just finished watching 2008's Felon. Thought it was a good movie. Val in that movie doesn't get talked about enough. Great performance there." All right, Scal.
Maybe I've not seen it, so I have no comment, but maybe I should check it out.
Yeah, exactly. He also said Val also cameoed in the Psych finale. As I said, Detective Dobson, seeing him in one of my all-time favorite shows was cool to see. I bet Sal. I bet it was.
Psych is a lot of fun. Karen, my ex, loved that show, so I watched about half of it, and it's very, very fun. But I never saw the finale.
All right, and then two of the Streamlabs here. Justin Toner says, "What's up, Justin? Good to see you." He says, "Hi, John. And Steve, I have been a fan of Val Kilmer ever since I saw Willow as a kid, ditto Top Gun, and then my love for him became permanent after seeing him as Doc Holliday in Tombstone. So many other great movies like Heat on his resume, just a great actor. And yes, I rewatched the documentary Val as well about his life and career on Prime Video. Moved me even more now that he is gone. For those who have never seen it, go watch it." Yeah, absolutely. It is such an incredible documentary, as Steve was mentioning earlier. And it's a great way to, I don't know, appreciate. I mean, I think that documentary with the Top Gun Maverick scene is a great headstone for the career and life of Val Kilmer. And so if you haven't watched that, like Justin was saying, I encourage you, and I'm sure Steve does as well, to watch that documentary to have a better idea of Val Kilmer. So, yeah. Okay. For me personally, you know, I love the Rebels, man. I'm the outlaw for a reason is what I intend. It was what I like. And when the Rebels march to their own drums, sometimes it ain't pretty. Sometimes it ain't nice. Sometimes the results aren't as great as their highest of highs. And they're in the wilderness for a while. But look how long he lived. He lived long enough to get reappreciated all over again, and he passed away at the right time. It's very similar to the Ultimate Warrior in my mind. The Ultimate Warrior had been a big star and then went into the wilderness, talked all kinds of crap about what had made him famous, and then at the tail end of his career realized all the stuff he had done, had a come to Jesus moment, asked for forgiveness, sought closure, delivered a beautiful speech on Monday Night Raw, talking about fighting and not knowing how much longer he has and to always appreciate every day and every moment, and died from a heart attack the next day. And so it's just those kinds of things where you have people who you loved as a youth and they get older and they go into these weird wild places and wilderness places, and you wonder what's going to happen and why aren't they more famous or why aren't they doing all these things? And then they find their way back to the spotlight just in time to say goodbye. And I think there's nothing more beautiful than that in a lot of ways, because they stayed true to who they were, regardless of the results, and in the end found their way back into our hearts again. And I think Val Kilmer did that before he passed away. And that's something amazing and doesn't always happen in life. And so it's something to really appreciate, in my opinion.
That's beautiful, John. Yeah. I don't really think I have anything to add. It was funny when you went to the Ultimate Warrior, I was like, well, where is this going? How is this? And it actually was really... That's really moving. I think that was a really wonderful way to put it. I got nothing to add to the life of Val Kilmer from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, okay. Well, thank you all so much for joining us for this live conversation and tribute and remembrance and discussion on the legacy of Val Kilmer. We can't tell you how much we love you all and really appreciate you all here on the Cinephiles, whether you're supporting us on the Patreon or just supporting us by downloading and listening to all of our stuff that we have going on. I hope you enjoyed our new intros we did for Heat and for Top Gun that are out there for you all to enjoy, and our new intro that we did for When We Were Kings for the passing of George Foreman that all came out just this past week, and our new short that dropped as well just a couple of days ago or a few days ago. We hope you enjoyed all of that. And of course, we have Fargo Part 1 coming up next week as we wrap up our season of the Coen brothers. Steve, anything more we need to say and tell our people?
Well, we're also going to be re-releasing our other Coen Brothers shows, which is No Country for Old Men and The Big Lebowski, yes, with new intros. So that's going to be coming up in the next couple of weeks. And we just had a little text conversation and figured out what the movie after Fargo is going to be. Would you feel comfortable if I announce that, John?
Yes, please. Knock yourself out.
We are diving back into a tiny little movie of the MCU called Ant-Man. Yay. So and I'm totally looking forward to spending some time with some Paul Rudd. I think is going to be a lot of fun after everything we've been through. It's been a tough year so far, and Paul Rudd, I think, is going to give us a lot of joy. Ant-Man's a lot of fun as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. We could use a little humor, and it'll coincide with the release of Thunderbolts, so we'll be in a Marvel's mindset when Ant-Man comes out. So I hope you all will join us for those episodes coming up here on the Cinephiles. Where can they join us on the Patreon, Steve? If they're new listeners or new viewers and they want to support the work we're doing, where can they find us?
Well, if you want ad-free versions of the show or to listen to our Cinephiles short, we just recorded a good one a few days ago, and we got another one coming up next week. You can go to patreon.com/thecinephiles. And if you want to join the tier that is the advisory board, we have meetings once a month to discuss where the Cinephiles is going and also just have fun movie conversations with some people who really, really love films. And if you want to reach me, it's at SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
Yeah, please remember to subscribe to the channel down below and hit that bell button and leave your comments about Val. And if you want to follow me, you could follow me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky and Threads as well. I guess I'm on there as well. So would appreciate that. And my YouTube channel, youtube.com/John Roca Says. I'm so determined to get to 50,000 subscribers. We're at 37.4 right now. Would love to get to 50. So if you haven't tried out any of my content, please head on over there. youtube.com/John Roca Says The Outlaw Nation. See all the great shows we have going on there as well. All right, for my partner, Steve Morris, I am John Roca. Thanks so much for watching this episode of the Cinephiles Live, and we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode here on the Cinephiles. Peace. Until then.